This is Don Hassig with Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth Pollution-Free Revolution. Joining us today is Dr. Peter Defer. He's with Environmental Stewardship Concepts. Good morning, Dr. Defer.
Good morning, Don. It's good to be here.
Well, we are joyous to have you with us because you are an expert in an area that we have found of great interest and of great significance to public health, this matter of dioxin exposure and cancer outcome, especially the quantification of the cancer outcome, because everybody realizes there are many, many exposures that contribute to cancer causation, but whether they contribute significantly or not at the level in which the exposure generally takes place for the public, that's a separate matter, and it's so very nice to have more and more scientific knowledge regarding that part of cancer causation. So I would like to begin speaking with you about the US EPA dioxin reassessment. The reassessment began in April of 1991. Here we are, September of 2010. So we're nearing the 20th birthday of this draft dioxin reassessment.
That's right.
Recently, a report was published by the US EPA. It's a draft 2010 report, and its short title is the EPA reanalysis ... report. Can you tell us about this report and give us the full title, because you know better than I do, and let's get started on this.
Okay, Don. Well, I'm happy to tell you about it. I didn't open a copy of the report file on my computer, so the full title is not in front of me either.
Okay.
It is the reanalysis of the dioxin reassessment in response to a review conducted by the National Academy of Sciences several years ago. The history that you started is more complex, as one can imagine, as I'm sure your readers who followed this are fully aware. But for those who've not followed this and who have not been dioxin groupies for 20 years can find out. Actually, prior to 1991, EPA had started but never completed a component of this analysis of dioxin. It was back in 1988, so 3 years beforehand, EPA had started to assess the exposures of the general population to the chemical known as dioxin. And that never went anywhere. That was derailed. But then in 1991, EPA started it again. And then they realized within a very few months that the effort was going to be larger than they had anticipated. And they were going to actually have to do quite a bit of work. And each year, they realized there was more and more to do. The reassessment back in 1991 began when the industry came to EPA, then Administrator William Riley, and said, you know, this compound known as dioxin that everybody says is so worrisome, well, we think that might not be so worrisome at all. We think that dioxin only causes cancer at the highest exposure doses, and we think, in fact, that at low exposures, that dioxin doesn't do anything, that it has a threshold for effects, and at the sort of population exposure levels we're looking at, we don't expect anything to happen. And William Riley said, oh, really? Let's get our scientists to take a look at that. And so scientists began to look at this question within EPA, and EPA enlisted the wisdom of outside scientists, academic scientists, research scientists, and the scientific community very quickly debunked that notion on the industry's part and determined that dioxin is actually a more potent carcinogen and causes a number of other health effects in addition to cancer that are related to its cancer-causing ability. So EPA then released a draft, an initial draft, and they embarked on an effort to understand the effects and predict the effects on wildlife. And in 1992, they came out with a first draft report, and then there was another one a few years later, and then another one a few years after that, and each time EPA added more to the story. At the same time, scientists around the world had been investigating situations in which dioxin exposure was either known to occur or suspected. The best known cases of these were reported by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH. Marilyn Sweeney and Marilyn Fingerhut published a paper in the 90s about occupational exposures to dioxin in the United States. And in that paper, they provided some data that were then used to help estimate the cancer-causing potential or the carcinogenicity, which was then raised by EPA. EPA raised the carcinogenicity in the 90s as a result of that information. The Europeans began investigating population exposures and the health consequences within the vicinity of several industrial facilities. And most notably, the entire scientific community around the world focused on two very well-known dioxin exposures, one that occurred in Seveso, Italy, in the mid-70s, and the other exposures were those that occurred to the general population in Vietnam as a result of spraying Agent Orange, which was contaminated with dioxin. As time has gone on and scientists have gathered an increasing amount of data on the general population exposures in several of those incidences, EPA has come to realize that non-cancer effects are more varied and more serious than ever anticipated, and that dioxin, the chemical known as dioxin, is a more potent carcinogen than ever believed. So in the year 2000, EPA completed two new efforts, which were supposed to be the last two efforts. One of them was a complete characterization of the risks. This effort is the last chapter, we can say, the summary chapter that brings it all together. And the other chapter was a description of how you understand and measure the different activities of different forms of dioxin, because as I said, it exists in a variety of forms, some of which are almost as toxic as the one we know, and others have no measurable toxicity. So how you put those together and how you add them up is a matter of some scientific interest and regulatory controversy. But in 2000, EPA completed those two efforts. It was peer-reviewed, EPA wrapped it up, and they created a document in 2003, and it went to the National Academy of Sciences. And then EPA has been cogitating for several years on the report from the National Academy of Sciences. And now they've revised their document, and this reanalysis contains the response to the suggestions of the National Academy of Sciences, important updates and important revisions. And as large as the reanalysis document is, it's not the reassessment.
Right. Yeah, well, that's a very well-stated history. I thank you so much for, you know, giving us that. Why is it taking so long, you know? Is that something that, you know, we can, you know, help the readers understand, well, listeners understand? See, the way I see it, you just can't use science to prevent cancer fast enough. That we just can. We always think use science to prevent cancer, science for cancer prevention. That's the International Agency for Research on Cancer's mantra, and we've adopted that mantra as well. So just science to prevent cancer. And then we just see the fact that the science, it is being done, and it's being used in certain ways. But see, the way we see science for prevention of cancer is that every once in a while, as the science accumulates, then the public would have this transferred to them in this rapid kind of manner, this rapid-fire manner, and then the people could make their own minds about, say, how much of an effort to make to reduce their dioxin exposure. And we see the dioxin reassessment as this perfect, you know, storm for having, say, news hooks and, you know, public interest and just, you know, say, getting done the dioxin reassessment with this wonderful moment in raising public knowledge of dioxin exposure, cancer risk, to a higher level. And so we're frustrated that it's taking so long to do the final draft. It seemed to me truly that in 2003, they were, you know, they had done enough, and it was a great time to share this with the public in a final draft. Where's, you know, the explanation of why we didn't, you know, say, get a final dioxin reassessment in, say, 2004 or 2005?
I think I have one perspective on that, and you and I could probably, within an hour's time, get on the phone and find six different perspectives each.
Okay.
But let me tell you what I think about that question. It's a very important one, and I know that your listeners want to know what has EPA been doing for 6 years, because they completed their report in 2003. They sent it to the National Academy of Sciences, and unless you're familiar with the way the National Academy works, you might expect this review to take a little while. But actually, most of the activities of the National Academy are conducted by the National Research Council, their operating arm, under two-year efforts. So most of the time, they take a 24-month period. It takes them 3 or 4 months to get everything in place, to assemble a study committee or a review committee. And then for a document as massive as the reassessment, they had to have a substantial group, and even if they were only asking a few questions, they've got to look at a lot of documents, and a lot of it's technical. So it turns out to be 2004, before, or 2005 before they hear anything back from the National Academy. So my perspective on what's happened in several years since then is that EPA held the document and was very cautious about and thorough about analyzing the comments from the National Academy and how they could possibly respond to them without having to start all over again. My interpretation of the way the document has come out, which I know was formulated and drafted over more than a year's time period. We saw this document out a couple of months ago, if memory serves,
right.
May or June.
Yep, May, right? I think it was May.
May. We saw that in May of 2010. And in February of 2009, more than a year prior to that, EPA held a public scientific technical meeting in Cincinnati, at which they assembled various people who've been involved with the reassessment over the years to have a discussion about what remaining technical issues EPA needed to address as they responded to the Academy and as they finalized the reassessment. So they've spent a year just doing some more analysis, which means crunching some numbers, doing some additional literature work, reviewing some additional work that's come out. And I think that's been substantive work that they've done over the year. Hmm. But in the intervening years, my impression is that EPA held the document and was very slow to release it, because once they sent it out of their office, it was going to go to the Office of Management and Budget in an administration that was very loath to see extra regulations on industry. And the Office of Management and Budget under the Bush White House had already sent signals that they had no interest in seeing the dioxin reassessment completed and released. Now, there are further consequences of the completion and release of the dioxin reassessment. As you said, we've come to understand that dioxin is a far more powerful and effective carcinogen. One of the investigations that many of your listeners will be familiar with is the investigation of the Vietnam vets, the so-called ranch hand study, which studied the health consequences of dioxin ex- exposure to those veterans who had handled Agent Orange during Vietnam. And many of your listeners, as is my case, and I imagine is your case, know someone who either died or has a family member who died as a result of exposure to Agent Orange in Vietnam. And as that group of veterans has been studied, they've expanded the number of cancers and the number of non-cancer health effects. I was speaking to a community group organizer who is a nurse, and one of her tasks is to work with the Vietnam vets. And she said that she has been astounded over the years to watch the list of cancers and other health effects due to dioxin exposure increase. It just keeps growing. She says we have this long list of cancers that have been attributed to dioxin exposure in those vets. And with that list growing, it means that once the dioxin reassessment is completed, and once EPA finalizes its new cancer potency, and it finalizes its estimate of what might be a safe dose for non-cancer effects, and those numbers can be used throughout the country by state and federal agencies to regulate, to clean up, and to make legally binding decisions. But until they finalize it, those decisions are still going to be based on older values, on older numbers, and on previous assessments of cancer-causing ability and non-cancer effects and what might be considered an effect without an exposure without an effect.
Exactly.
I was recently reviewing another document that had to do with dioxin, and EPA was estimating cancer. The cancer potency number, or carcinogenicity that they were using, dates back into the 80s.
Well,
and I know why they were using it, because that was the last formal approved number that EPA had. Not like IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, to which you referred, and they formally declared dioxin was a carcinogen in 1997. And then the U.S. National Toxicology Program, part of NIEHS, which is part of NIH, for your viewers, for your listeners, NIH, National Institute of Health, NIEHS, National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, and Environmental Health Sciences created the National Toxicology Program many years ago due to the efforts of the late David Rawl, who was the first director of the National Toxicology Program. And they identified dioxin as a cancer, as a known human carcinogen, long before EPA came close to that. And in fact, I'm not even sure that EPA still has officially identified dioxin as a known human carcinogen.
Right.
Because it's that official designation that holds us back, holds back EPA. And as you pointed out, scientists who are in environmental health business really should all be dedicated to the notion that you pointed out before of using science to protect the public health and to prevent cancer. And we have the capacity to take a great deal of scientific information, a substantial body of data, to inform people and to permit improved actions at the state and the federal level that will prevent cancers.
See, what we're finding, Dr. Defer, is that government is so huge, and the exposures, the presence of the chemical pollutants such as dioxins and other persistent organic pollutants, other POPs, that are in our environment, in our food, in the soil, in our bodies, there's such a presence of these chemicals, and there's so many of them, and there's such a great amount of activity that keeps these chemicals in our environment. We've been trying to work with the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, to bring about a change that would go a long ways toward reducing exposure. And this would mean that FDA would label animal fat containing foods so as to make known to the consumer the presence of carcinogenic POPs in these products, in these foods. And in addition, that they would prohibit the use of waste animal fat in the feeding of food animals. And they have had this petition, this citizen petition, this formal citizen petition that our group put together and submitted since January of, they put it into their dockets in January of 2004. And then they notified us that they had done this, and then it was just the end of the story. Nothing happened. We never heard another word out of them. In 2009, we decided to just start pushing on this. And then they started, you know, responding slightly. They promised us that they would give us like a substantive scientific response. They broke it down. It was going to come partly from CVM, the Center for Veterinary Medicine, the labeling piece, and then CIFSAN, the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. They're part of both part of FDA. They were going to cover the base of the. No, I take that back. They were going to do the part about the labeling and CVM. They were the ones that were responsible for the matter of the prohibition against the use of the waste animal fat in the food animal feeds. And yet the months go on and the years pass by and they're still not giving us this response. They say it's in their Office of General Counsel now, which means it's, you know, deep in trouble. You know, the lawyers are looking at it. And, wow, it's unreal. And it's so simple. It's all so simple. You know, you just don't put this stuff in the food of animals that we eat. And it's so simple, you just don't eat it yourself. And it's so simple, it causes a lot of cancer. And people should just be, and you know, that's the simplest part of it, is that we wouldn't really even have to just, you know, focus on dioxin. If we were to think about the long list of these chemical carcinogens that are known to various degrees as either known animal carcinogens, suspected human carcinogens, known human carcinogens, but there's so many of them that contaminate animal fat that any sound-minded, reasonable person will just want to tell their kid, you know, that this is the state of the science and this is the state of our environment and our industry and our society and our life. And they certainly don't want those chemicals in their body any more than they can control now because they get exposed to them in utero. Their mom get exposed to them in utero. The generations just keep passing by that these kinds of exposures take place at unnecessarily high levels.
That's so right. You,
wow.
Yeah, you bring up some really important points there. And, you know, they all center around the question about what are we waiting for and why are we
exactly.
so slow to act.
Exactly.
And the petition about labeling sounds a little bit like California's Proposition 65.
Yep.
It's a component of it. It's
yep.
And for your listeners who aren't familiar with Proposition 65, I urge you to look it up on the web. You can find out a lot about it, a little bit about its history. It goes back a number of years. It goes back, in fact, quite a number of years. And I remember that one of the requirements is that any consumer product, including food or office materials, everything sitting on my desk, everything sitting on Don's desk right now, for your listeners at home, everything sitting around your living room, dining room, kitchen, sold in California that contains either a carcinogen or a reproductive and developmental toxicant, known carcinogen, has to be labeled with that content information. It isn't a ban. It isn't a restriction on its use. It's simply a labeling requirement so that when you pick up a coffee mug to buy it and give it away as a gift, if that coffee mug contains lead, it has to say so. It has to
yep.
say, this contains a compound which is known to cause blah, blah, blah. This requirement also extends to entering buildings or other facilities so that when you go into the hotel, there will be a sign on the door. If they've used compounds in the construction or operation of that building that are known human carcinogens, and it will say, be aware of the fact that when you're entering this building, there are chemicals used in here or used in its construction that are known human carcinogens or known to disrupt the normal development or reproductive function or whatever it is that the language language requires.
So they must have to make an awful lot of those signs, right?
They do. They do. It's everywhere. And you know that a manufacturer, if they want to sell stuff in California, they're going to have to put this label on their product. They're not going to make two different products. That label is going to go on throughout the United States. Now, some manufacturers have found a way to effectively get around that requirement so that they don't have to broadcast it throughout the other 49 states and territories and Europe and the rest of the developed world where they might want to sell their products, that it only goes in California. But this requirement does matter, and it has made a difference, and it's the state equivalent of the right to know toxic release inventory effort at the federal level. And you raised the question about the multiple chemicals, which the Proposition 65 is designed to address. And it's true that most of us, if not all of us, have a variety of chemicals, a number of which are known to cause cancer, floating around in our bodies. Yes, I'm afraid your listeners are going to have to face the fact that everybody sitting out there listening to our conversation has measurable amounts not only of dioxin, but also the related chemicals, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs. I would bet that we all have at least some DDT, pesticide that was banned decades ago, chlordane, flame retardants, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, also in our bodies, and a great variety of chemicals, some of which are known to cause cancer, and as you pointed out, some of them which are only suspected of causing cancer. You can go to the website for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and type into their search engine that you want to find out about this information. And it's present on a study reported as NHANES, N-H-A-N-E-S. It's a study that the Centers for Disease Control conducts regularly, and they take samples. They get volunteers to give them samples, tissue samples, blood samples, hair. I think they even do fat samples from around the country, random sample, and then they find out what the population is like in terms of their body composition and what our body burden is for a variety of chemicals. Through this method, we've discovered something really important in our conversation. We've been talking about dioxin and its presence and what we could do, what successes we could achieve if we reduced or eliminated our exposures. Consumers could make wise choices. They could make wiser choices. They could eat less animal fat. They could, the FDA and USDA could make decisions about animal feed, get more fat out of the food chain. And what would that mean? Those decisions, those choices, and changing those behaviors would reduce the amount of dioxin and other fat-loving pollutants that we take in and that we retain. We did this experiment at the national level with lead, and I'm sure that you've got some background that makes it familiar to you, Don.
Surely.
Some of the listeners will be familiar with the fact that we used to put lead in gasoline and lead in paint and lead in a lot of other things. And then finally, we got the lead out, figuratively and literally. Once we started removing lead from these various products, especially from gasoline, the amount of lead in the average U.S. citizen began to decline dramatically. And those data are present on the website for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Once you stop the source, then the exposures decrease and the amount in the average population decreases as well. And the proposal is, let's just apply that same lesson to other pollutants, and in this particular case, cancer-causing dioxins and related compounds. Let's get those sources out. We don't need to carry any more around in our bodies than we have now, and in fact, a lot less would be better, particularly because there are some members of the population that are already way overexposed to dioxin, probably the ones that are far more sensitive. I refer to infants and breastfed babies and people who are living within the vicinity of a source. The reason why people who are living near a source are overexposed is because of their proximity. You're just closer. You're living downwind and within the plume of a facility that emits dioxin, you're going to have a higher exposure.
Well, you know what?
But why not get that out? Why not get it out of there?
Yep. Just to stop you there for a minute, we are just yesterday, I just got into doing a news release about one of these sources, you know, you're referring to. We're in New York State, and Onondaga County is in central New York State, Syracuse, big metropolitan area in Onondaga County, and all of the solid waste from Onondaga County is burned in a municipal solid waste incinerator. They have an incinerator monitoring program, and I've been looking at the data and trying to, once again here, use science, scientific data, to prevent cancer. The data shows a constant marching higher of the levels, you know, the concentrations of carcinogenic metals and dioxins. Well, no, I take that back. Let's start over again. The data from the Onondaga County Incinerator Monitoring Program demonstrates that levels of carcinogenic metals are increasing across the boards. We're talking about arsenic, cadmium, chromium, lead, nickel. These levels, the concentrations in the soils of Onondaga County are increasing where they're doing this monitoring. At the same time, we see levels of dioxin in certain soil samples, that exceed the EPA's proposed remediation guidelines for dioxin in soil. And here again, there's been this huge change. It used to be 1,000 ppt, 1,000 parts per trillion. Now the proposed remediation guideline goal, PRG, proposed preliminary remediation goal, that number has gone down to slightly over 3. It's like 3.7 parts per trillion. And this is all about the huge amount of science that's accumulated since that 1,000 ppt PRG was set in place. All these decades that have passed since that goal was set in place have been the decades when all this science that you've been describing that has caused one to conclude that dioxin exposure causes more cancer. That science has been accumulating, and now EPA is considering establishing this new PRG. But anyways, getting back to Syracuse and the Onondaga County incinerator, we see these levels of dioxin in residential soils that are above the cleanup guideline, the proposed cleanup guideline that's cancer protective. And we contact the Onondaga County Public Health Department and the Onondaga County Legislature, and all they basically say is, you know, don't dig up, you know, the old story. You know, we've already decided. See, they don't understand that there's no such thing as digging up the old story. Just because they decided it was okay to do this back in the old days, back in the, you know, their health risk assessment is dated 1990. So, you know, they were only looking at science. It was like back before any of the science that you've been talking about this whole time and any of the science that, you know, I'm familiar with. So they certainly don't have a clue about how much cancer and other chronic diseases are caused by the exposure to these metals and dioxin from that incinerator. They do once a year stack testing on notice of the facility, meaning that the fox knows, you know, when the, you know, the chickens are going to be testing,
right,
testing for the dioxin emissions. And I know Syracuse pretty well, and I know it's like this kind of place where making money really rules. And to, you know, I'm certainly not under any illusions about the variability of the dioxin emissions of that incinerator. And so for EPA and New York State DEC and Onondaga County to all claim that their emissions are at a certain level based upon once a year stack testing on notice, that's just absurd. You know, no one, knowing the variability of dioxin emissions, when there are different materials burned, they change. When they're shut down, when they're start up, when there's malfunction, so many things contribute to differences in dioxin emissions. And this once-a-year stack testing should go. It's in Europe they do continuous dioxin emission monitoring. So, and getting back to this story about the data from the monitoring program, they are ignoring it. DC says, you know, like, just, we're not going to comment, you know, we're not going to even talk to you about this, you know, this trend in the data that you've seen and this, these dioxin levels that are above the proposed PRGs. And the county, they said they would talk to us, but they never talked. They actually have a chair of the Onondaga County Legislature. His name is James Reinhart. He said to me, don't talk to me about dioxins in animal fat, even though that's the main way people get exposed to dioxin. He said, I'm into, you know, my business is beef. I sell beef to clubs all around the U.S., and I just don't want to talk about this. And I said, well, God, I have to talk about it, because an important part of exactly what you said, the people that live close to the facility get this exposure added on top of the exposure they get from consuming the food supply of the whole country and the whole world that's contaminated with these chemicals, dioxins and other POPs. There are some of them known carcinogens and some suspected carcinogens.
Yeah.
So
yeah, Don,
this is
two things. A couple of weak links in our system here are that, I guess the first point that you raised is that we have new information, we have new scientific evidence, we have new analyses, and we would expect, you and I and many of your listeners would expect, that this new information is then used by our decision makers, regulators, policymakers to make better informed decisions, and that we've discovered that there are activities that we once thought were okay and are not okay. And our society has always been successful in improving our decision making on the basis of new information. And we can point to example after example after example of making those decisions about drugs that we thought were safe and discovered that they're no longer safe, about chemicals in commerce. I talked about lead. Now, I've got colleagues who will argue that we have always known lead was a neurotoxin and should never have put it in gasoline in the first place.
Right.
That was our failure to learn from history long ago. If you go to medical practices, there are medical practices that were used in the 50s that were considered to be the best available knowledge and the best practice at the time. And then they discovered they weren't really as ideal, and they gave them up and they started using something differently. We do things differently inside hospitals. We do things differently in schools. We do things differently in our homes than we always have, because we gather new information. We make decisions about how to carry out practices better. So we need to apply that same principle rather rigorously to environmental health practices and what we are and are not doing and allowing in the way we conduct various practices in society. You look at farming, and we've discovered that no-till farming has a great benefit to the environment. So it's being adopted widely. It's being adopted in many places. The Dust Bowl of the 30s in the Great Southwest was created in no small part because of bad farming practices, and improved farming practices have done a tremendous amount of good. We've improved water quality. We've improved air quality by learning from the information that we had, learning lessons from our past.
Right.
So why shouldn't we be doing this same philosophy now? Why should we not take this new information about dioxins and emissions and increasing concentrations of metals as well as organic compounds? We should. There's every reason why we should. And we are slow to adopt what's going to be either expensive or difficult. And I think that slowness is part of the problem at the national level as well. The other point you raise is a very interesting one, an important one for your listeners to know about, and is not new to dioxin controversy. And that is that the source of dioxins, as people can find out if they don't know, is largely from chemical processes or high temperature combustion of organic matter in the presence of metals and chlorine. So that we had it as a contaminant in the manufacture of pesticides, herbicides in this particular case, that were made with chlorinated organic chemicals. It was a side product. Contaminant, wasn't intentionally manufactured. Incinerators create it because they have organic matter, they have metals, they have a source of chlorine. And so dioxins are formed in incinerators and cement kilns and paper mills because they use chlorine for bleaching, or they did. And the better paper mills have gone to hydrogen peroxide bleaching. So a variety of changes have been instituted because those were the original sources. And then they were deposited into the food supply. The food supply industry then became the target. They became victimized. They became very sensitive about the fact that they were selling a product that was now considered to be contaminated. Well, the food supply industry is not the problem. They're not the source. They have every business to be upset with the part of the industry that's the source. They need to go after the incinerators. They need to go after the manufacturers and let them know they need to stop putting out dioxins and metals and stop putting out carcinogens that are then getting into their food supply. Back in the mid-90s, after the dioxin reassessment first draft was released, there was a huge effort on the part of, I think it was the beef industry. They went around the country, they were telling people beef was safe, and they were trying to debunk the whole notion that dioxin was more of a problem. And the reason being, as you pointed out, as many people know, is that it's carried in animal fat. Whoa. Well, that doesn't mean that that's where it comes from. That means that's how we get exposed. So we need
exactly.
to learn how to get it out of the food supply. And we're not going to do it by hiding our heads in the sand.
And I'll tell you, we will never get FDA to take any kind of action such as what we've requested they take, this banning of that feeding practice of the waste animal fat to food animals, or the labeling. They will not do that until lots of people, you know, lots of Americans that have a mouth and have fingers and can dial telephones and, you know, do email and just communicate, until lots of them are knowledgeable on this. And it's like this catch-22. You got to get the knowledge going somehow, and nothing happens until you get the knowledge. And our radio program is small, and we're hoping that it's somewhat of an effective tool in educating. We're very happy. This Dr. James Mercola has just done a great interview with a Canadian veterinarian. He's originally from India, and he worked in Canada for a while in the former entity that has now become Health Canada. He's in food safety. And one of the five pillars, as he calls them, of these problems with the food supply, you know, these things that must, these five pillars that must all be changed, is Dr. Shiv Chopra. He's pointing to the use of these rendered products, including the fat product, in the production of food, whether it means directly going into food that we eat or going directly into the food that the animals that we eat are eating. So we're really happy to have all of these new ways of educating just coming on the scene right when we need so much education.
And I think you're exactly right about getting a lot of community activism and a lot of ordinary citizens to contact both the FDA and their officials and say, you know, we want food labeled as to its content. We want to know what's in the animal fat. We want to know where it comes from. We want to know, for example, if the salmon are genetically engineered, story that's been in the news recently. We want to know if FDA has tested the beef supply and has found that there are certain levels of dioxins, PCBs, or other carcinogens. I think the more we have the citizens communicating that, because people want healthy food.
That's right.
They want to know their food supply is safe. And there's no reason why the government shouldn't uphold their responsibility. I was asked one time what I thought were the primary functions of government. Isn't it to protect individual rights? And I said, living in the Commonwealth of Virginia, I said, well, we can't forget that the government also has a responsibility to protect the common good.
That's right.
Public health and welfare is right up there.
Right. Whatever happened to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness? How happy are people that have cancer or have a kid that has some horrible, you know, B behavioral problem that resulted from an in utero exposure to some of these chemicals.
That's right.
There's no happiness in that. There is no happiness. I have not found the happiness that I believe my father found, and it's because he wasn't exposed to many of these chemicals in utero. He was from a generation. He was born in 1923. And certainly his mom did not have any of these chemicals we're talking about in her body because they all came on the scene after World War II, you know, in like the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. You know,
right.
We are just being beat up so badly by this stuff, and we're
right.
suffering from it, and there's no happiness in it. And our government is truly the final protector of the, you know, the public's happiness and their health. All these things that we truly cannot protect ourselves because there's just too much going on. It's just too big a game. We need government to be our representative and be on our side. And what's really frustrating to me is that we discover again and again that government is not on our side. We look at it as, you know, the lapdog of the corporate overlord. And I know how you look at it, but that's the way we look at it. Sitting here in the San Andreas River Valley, when we're downwind from everything and downstream from everything that comes out of the Great Lakes and
yeah.
having our fish so contaminated and all these things, it's unreal.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I hope that your listeners will take this opportunity to do some research and to send a note. It doesn't take a lot. You can send an email to your representative and say, I want FDA to both investigate and label. I have seen data that FDA collects. FDA not only can, but has done a fair amount of food testing.
That's right.
Not just bacterial contamination that you read about in the front page of the paper, but also metals, organic compounds, such as the dioxins and PCBs. So they have some data. In fact, FDA data were available to EPA as EPA was updating their latest estimates of exposures to the general population and specific groups. And EPA's estimates came out really close to the measurements that FDA was making, and so they could sort of check their homework against one another. They found out that they were coming up with very similar numbers, and it was reassuring to have that check, but also a little frightening to know that we're all exposed to more dioxin than EPA considers to be safe.
That's
which
right.
is now a lower number now that we have new information. We want to use that. There are several sources of information that your listeners can rely on. Of course, you can go randomly around the web. You can get some information from my website, which is estewards.com, as in environmentalstewards.com. We put up there documents that we make available and then resources, including a link to the CDC website that I was talking about. And one of the things that we're doing is updating our website to make it easier to go straight to that investigation of tissue concentrations.
Okay.
Putting a direct link. And I know that your organization will have a website with some resources for listeners as well.
Yep, our website is www.canceractionny, as in New York, .org. And it's been wonderful talking with you, Dr. Defer. You certainly are expert in the area of dioxin exposure cancer outcome. And we need people like that around because it's rather complex. And yet it's not rocket science, it's not nuclear, you know, physics, quantum theory, nothing like that at all. And so the public can grasp it if they get a chance. So it's good to know that you're out there helping them have access to this information.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, Don, and to help your readers, listeners understand. And I hope that they'll do a little bit to find out a bit more and then make that next step and get in touch with their officials and their elected people and let them know what they want.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much, Don.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Defer. Have a great day.
All right, you too. Bye.
This is Don Hussig with Cancer Action Network. You've been listening to Loving the Earth, Pollution-Free Revolution. This radio program is available on the Internet at www.radio4all.net, www.radio4all.net. We're also broadcast from the Mad River Valley in Vermont. It's WMRW. That broadcast takes place on Tuesday afternoons at 4 p.m. So looking forward to preventing cancer using science and you know, love your body, Love the Earth, cancer-free world.